morning, Sozwar.
G'day, Mr. G'day, Mark. How are you, buddy? What's going on?
Fantastic, mate. Brilliant. Welcome to this episode of the Brass Monkey Podcast.
That funky monkey. Junkie.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're getting our background music, so we don't actually need to rap it or put some...
As much as we'd like to, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah, exactly. So how exciting to start off this new podcast with such a massive... after such a massive week and really to start off 2019.
Yeah, it's been huge, from bloody sport to politics to bloody everything seems to be kicking off.
I know.
Plenty to get through, plenty to talk about today.
So obviously the Super Bowl was on the weekend. Did you get a chance? You're saying you went down to watch it for one of the first times?
Yeah. I've over the years, at various stages, I've tried to put in a bit of investment in trying to understand the game and get into it, really. Like, when we're sort of over there hanging about, tried to do it over there. Had you know, relative success while immersed in it over there. But yeah, I thought I'd give it a really good crack for the Super Bowl, which actually was on Monday, our time, Monday morning, Australian time. So, found myself at the pub at 10 a.m. with a good friend of the show, Dave. And yeah, pretty much got stuck in, had some wings, had some beer, and watched what I can only describe as one of the most boring games of sport I've ever seen.
Yeah, I've watched quite a bit of NFL, and I'm not a massive fan or anything, but I do watch it. Like, I do, like, if the Super Bowl's on, I will make a point to go and watch it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that game was fucking dismal to watch, wasn't it?
That was particularly, grating on my sporting sensibilities.
Yeah, so you got two quarterbacks who basically weren't really converting, and they weren't really getting making any ground, and it was just fucking, it was like a punter's it was a really weird game to watch. And I'm not a mass, like, I'll watch it, I'm not a massive fan overall, but like, to see the Patriots win again and like to be in there nine times, like, to me there's something, I don't know, something a bit stale about that whole thing. And I think it's the viewership has clearly
taken a hit.
It's reacted to it, so it's down 7% from last year.
Do you think that particular stat is in, because they couldn't know that? I mean, I wonder how they get that stat. I wonder if that's like a result of the boycotting, or are people switching off during the game because it's so shit, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I reckon it's a number of things. I think it could be, part of just the fact that people are bored with New England being in the Super Bowl another year. But I think it also could be just the fact that with all of the bad publicity the NFL has had over the last probably 10, 15 years, I think fans have grown tired of them.
Yeah,
because I feel like they're like a big company that don't feel like they're untouchable, and that brings me to our one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is the halftime entertainment. Oh. I mean, what the fuck?
That's the only thing that came to my mind too. I in no way understand how the people that curate these things get jobs. So whether it's the AFL here or, you know, any sporting event I see, it's just terribly curated by whoever's doing the music.
So you're in, so it's held in Atlanta. So it's held in like potentially the greatest, like one of the greatest rap and hip hop areas in the US, would you say? Like it's.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, so
probably, it's the hottest, right?
You know? Yeah, the hottest rap, and so you could have pulled from a number of amazing rappers. Let's move Big Boy out because I love Big Boy.
It needed to be Outkast, not Big Boy.
It did need to be Outkast, but I think there is no way Andre 3000 would have agreed to play in the.
I know.
I just feel like it's something that he wouldn't have done. But to get Maroon 5 and have Maroon 5 up there is like saying, I feel like it's almost fuck you to African Americans. Oh, that sounds
maybe bad.
Man, even though that sounds like really, I'm not trying to do a hot take here, but. It's fucking so Atlanta.
I see what you're saying.
I've just written top Atlanta rappers. This isn't just musicians, these are just the rappers, right? Gucci Mane, T.I., Ludacris, Young Jeezy, Big Boy, Killer Mike, who would never play at it, Andre 3000, Usher, there you go. Childish Gambino, Donald Glover.
He'd see, if you wanted to get a semi has been fucking washed up. Get Usher. He would have been great.
Get Usher. I
would love to see Usher do the halftime show, you know?
100%. So, but they get...
aging, irrelevant white.
White.
Taking his shirt off, doing a bloody striptease. Oh, man. It grinded my gear something hard.
It was
such a bleak game anyway. I was kind of really looking forward to the halftime performance. And it disappointed massively.
Massively disappointed. There was nothing about it that sort of grabbed me or anything. And I don't know where the Super Bowl's going. I reckon it's
the game in general. It seems it's a little bit up in the air.
Yeah, the game in general. I reckon with the US population and their sort of disappointment with sort of how the concussions are being handled and like kids, like people are scared to let their kids play in it. I'm a strong believer they need to get rid of the headgear to stop people fucking leading with their heads. I mean, that's a simple.
We were speaking about this on Monday. Yeah. Quite simple controversial view, but yeah, it's, I think it's proven, isn't it? Like that it would reduce head injuries?
100% it would. And I just don't know why they don't. Yeah, I think it's a dying game, especially with like the NBA on the come up and everyone sort of loving what
for they're sure.
A lot more progressive. I think NFL is in a bad way.
Yeah, as a sporting package, they're up against it, I think, over the next sort of the generational change coming. Like in the next, whatever, 10 years or so. But I'm on that headgear thing. It's the same argument that the UFC has for trying to remove the gloves.
Yeah.
So that people would actually not get injured as much and the head trauma would be less because of the obvious repercussions on the hand. Like if you're going to go sit someone in the head, your hand will be messed up. You know, you've got to take that into consideration. But I think it is that the people are adverse to it just because the visual or the imagery of removing a piece of safety gear, they can't compute that that's actually makes it safer. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
It's like, you can't take away the helmets. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
5 seconds of research to sort of see, well, actually, there's great data to support that it is safer.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Not to bloody get on them, on the NFL in general, but how's old mate the MVP... started the season on the old PEDs.
Edelman? Did Edelman get it?
Yeah,
man, he's been on shit. They're all on everything, man. Like, look at how big they are. They're all on everything. I mean...
Are they?
Yeah, definitely, mate. Definitely. You can't be that huge and not on something. I just don't know how that works.
I don't know either. Well, if that's the case, then what's going on? It's, you know...
I mean...
From a peripheral observer... So much about it, like, so they need to be the toughest, the whatever. So they're the one sport that doesn't get checked, you're saying, or whatever, perhaps. But they're also the one sport that does fuck all per player as far as their physical exertion per game and per season. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're only ever out there for a couple of minutes and they change it to the defensive team or the whatever it is, offensive or defensive.
Yeah.
They're only playing for a minute, then they stop for a minute or two and have another go, and then they only play 16 games a season. I'm just thinking they're not bloody doing enough here, mate.
I'm with you, but it's all bursts. Like, so it suits steroids and stuff, so it's all bursts of energy. It's not like long sustained energy like a rugby game or a soccer game or something. So the steroids sort of help there. Just it's just like instant burst and then you're back. And that sort of works really well with steroids. So
the Patriots are cheaters as well.
Like
I know.
If you're looking at Deflategate and all that, like, and there's people like Bill Simmons and all that that go on about how, oh, it didn't happen. 100% happened. Like, there's no question. And then before Deflategate, they got busted videotaping the team that they were playing, I think, in the finals, practice sessions.
Yeah.
So this was years ago they got busted doing that. So, like, they're fucking...
It's weird.
Yeah, man. Like, there's a reason why, A, this team's got into so many finals, and, B, that they win is because they're probably doing dodgy shit.
Yeah.
And all this, one thing I want to say also is all this GOAT and greatest of all time talk of Tom Brady, shut the fuck up. I don't want to hear that he is the greatest athlete of all time. Yeah, well, that's what they're saying because he's fucking been to nine. But they're comparing him to – well, some are comparing him to Jordan. And it's just like, get out. Don't come near me.
Yeah, no, it can't even come in the conversation when there's cheating in the mix. Sorry.
No, exactly. Well, that sort of cheating, yeah. So, mate, yeah, it was a trying day. It was a trying day. I went out with a few guys from the office and we watched it. And look, we got so bored. We're at the casino, literally half of a big bar in the casino, and half of the people that were at the bar just like left halfway through and started gambling because it was just boring as hell. I think, yeah, it's strange. I'm reading about this Maroon 5 thing, and apparently they get $1.5 million on average per show. And apparently they did this for free, which is fucking crazy that Maroon 5 get $1.5 million per show.
Yeah, I can sort of see that, but why do they do it for free, I wonder?
They said from the moment Maroon 5 was announced as a headliner for Super Bowl 53 halftime show, everyone had some thoughts. Many felt that the band was a not powerful enough choice, and others thought that maybe it was a weak move from the NFL with all their other surrounding controversy. Like, no women...
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and they've got this whitest fucking nothing, like the worst stage presence in the world, Adam Levine. I'm glad we've got an artist this week that I can definitely shit on without getting in trouble. So,
yeah, that's nice, isn't it? Well, you never know, actually.
Well,
but with that, like.
Moving on.
Yeah, yeah. No, with.
Yeah, no, so like Adam Levine. No stage presence.
Oh, just the song, the catalogue from Maroon 5.
Oh,
it's not suited to high energy sport.
No.
Fuck. Beautiful. I just can't even. They were such puss hits anyway. So yeah. Imagine, I'm sort of just picturing Chad and Brad in the bloody stadium trying to rock out and basically falling asleep. I feel sorry for Chad and Brad.
Yeah, I actually don't even think...
It just wasn't suited at all.
Yeah, and I also wonder how Maroon 5 even got big in the first place. There must have been a lot of money behind them or something, because I remember that first song that they did, and he's clearly tried to turn himself into, like, a tough guy by getting tats and shit. Himself.
Yeah.
But it's all... We can see through that, like... Come on.
Yeah, I can sort of see their success. Like, they can write a tune. He's got a decent voice. They've got a bit of groove behind
them. Okay.
But, just not to the level they've got to, and particularly not well suited to a halftime show.
At a Super Bowl, maybe at like a figure skating event or something.
Yes, yes, perhaps. Well, yeah, some gymnastics, something of this nature for sure.
Yeah. So this Let is actually, yeah, yeah, this is, so the Super Bowl is actually a really, the halftime show is a really good segue into what else we were going to talk about on the pod today, which was the Fyre Festival documentary.
Yes, everyone's seen it. We're sure our listeners have seen it. It's bloody, it's a good one, actually, a good documentary, isn't it?
Good documentary, and it follows, so basically the background, if you haven't seen it,
yeah,
it follows a sort of a entrepreneur, you could say, tech guy, Billy McFarland, and his desire to create a music festival in the Bahamas. Is that a good
sort of intro? Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah, we're trying to set up and make what was marketed as the most luxurious festival experience known to man ever.
So he got all of these Instagram models. Yeah, so to start with, before he even had a festival, a proper location, a band or anything, him and his partner in this, Ja Rule, which...
Yeah.
Clearly,
he's giving shout out to friend of the show, Ja.
Yeah, Ja. They threw a like a planning party almost, which involved like Bella Hadid and Emily Ratajkowski or whatever her name is.
Yeah,
is that how do you say that? Like all the top 10 stunning Victoria's Secret models in the world flew them down the Bahamas and got crazy photos with them.
In a fully concerted and planned marketing campaign to sort of, yeah, portray the image and the lifestyle that they were trying to achieve at this festival, right?
Correct, correct. Which he said was apparently at Pablo Escobar's island, but later on it was found out it wasn't Pablo Escobar's island.
Nor was it an island. Yeah.
Nor was it an island in the end.
Yeah.
So they went on, Ja and him, and if you watch the documentary, it just got to the point where nothing was really happening. And spoiler alert, and the planning of this whole festival was just falling apart.
Basically turned into a bit of a Lord of the Flies.
Anything.
You there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Lord of the Flies.
Yeah, yeah, just kind evolved of scene. Into a sort of, yeah, Lord of the Flies scene. The guy's delusional, as far as I can tell.
He's a real weird one. So he is currently... he ended up getting 6 years in prison and was ordered to forfeit $26 million, which is a lot of money.
It's a shitload of money, but he ripped off a shitload of people too, didn't he?
Yeah, so basically he knew that this event wasn't going to go to plan and he still got all these people that were stuck on this island and they were stuck in the Bahamas with no way out. There were no flights out. The food was not even edible. Well, it was edible. I'll get to sort of that. But, it was just like all of these people that wanted this thing that they saw on Instagram, they wanted this sort of life and this crazy festival, but it was nothing like what it was promoted.
Yeah, and I think overall, for a lot of people, especially for me, that was the takeaway. Like, it was telling that something like this could potentially succeed. It's telling that something like this sold so many tickets, because by all accounts, it sold out, right? Or, like, close
to. Yeah, it sold out massively. Well, it sold to the point it sold out so far that he sold more tickets that weren't even, like, it oversold out.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just strange. And these tickets were not cheap. We're talking, I'm sure, thousands of dollars at the bare minimum. Up to, I'm pretty sure, $250K for one of them for a ticket. But, you know, it sort of speaks to the Instagram culture and that trying to live up to that image that is probably not real, you know what I mean? And he's made a whole festival based around that, and people have bought right into it. It's kind of sad a bit.
It's kind of sad, but it's also a little bit funny in a way.
It's funny, but it's sad that this kind of thing can be popular or successful.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But not that it was, but, you know, another guy organising it, it may well have come off.
Possibly. And it's just also amazing that how someone can get so much money from investors without, like, any substance. So without, like, any actual money behind him or any actual... do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, by all accounts, just must have had the absolute mad gift of the gab, as they say.
So if you haven't seen it, I've just realized in the last 1 minute of talking to you, I've explained this really bad. If you go to Fyre Festival, so type in F-Y-R-E and just festival, and you have a look at what happened if you haven't heard the story, it gives a better depiction than how we've sort of just explained it. It's definitely it's a cautionary tale for but if you're stupid enough to just go to a festival and book tickets to a festival on the basis of an Instagram post,
this is what I'm getting at. Yeah,
I guess that's what people are doing these days.
That's what I mean. Yeah, there's a great quote by one of the festival attendees I saw going around to something he tweeted out. He had won the tickets through a work raffle, so didn't pay for anything, but ended up on the island or whatever it was. Mm. And just he wrote how he had honestly the best time of his life just watching all these wannabe celebrity, quasi rich people melting down that their luggage was getting handled inappropriately and that their accommodation had fallen through, and he was just reveling in it. I think he said the quote is something like, it was nourishment for my middle class soul to see, you know what I mean? And I just love that idea.
Because I love that too, man. And I'm wondering, like, these aren't the same people that are going to Burning Man, are they?
Certainly not.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? So these sort of the people that were going, and I'm not shitting on the people that went to this festival. I mean, the some of the acts that he had lined up were like Major Lazer, who obviously is
decent, yeah.
Diplo, like he had Blink 182, all who started pulling out the night or two nights before after they started finding out that holy shit, this place is not legit. We can't
be associated with this. Yeah, Migos is another one, I'm pretty sure.
Fuck. But this guy, he just kept pushing on, which was, it reminds me totally of the escalation of commitment where you're in a business and you're just feeding good money after bad, and you just keep pouring good money after bad money. And he was in a hole and he just kept on digging, unfortunately.
Yeah, and wasn't able to sort of see the writing on the wall when he perhaps should have.
No.
It's a fascinating look at that, for sure, that sort of side of life.
It is a fascinating look, and I was mentioning to you maybe a couple of weeks ago about doing a shitty business ideas pod on like festivals and things like that. I've got my own... nothing like Fyre Festival, obviously, on a lot smaller scale, but I've got I've put my toe obviously in promoting and trying to do a gig. Have you got any stories or any instant like festivals that you've been booked to play at?
Mm-hmm.
That you've been like, holy shit, this is not going to happen? Or is it every festival you go to? Because I reckon with music and that and trying to arrange something so big, there's always going to be an element of chaos. But is there any that you've like you've got in your memory bank that you've turned up at and you've been like, oh shit, this is not going to happen? And you don't have to use names.
No, like off the top, I can't, nah. It's always, as you say, it's definitely an organized chaos. Most of them are. It just depends on which side they err, the more organized or the more chaos, you know what I mean? But mostly, yeah, to get these things going, you've got to be pretty switched on. So I've never experienced anything that was quite on the, or even nearing the scale of the fire festival bloody saga. But there's been some interesting ones. We went to one a couple of festivals ago. We got to the festival. It was about a 3.5 hour drive away. It was in the middle of nowhere, no reception. Anyway, long story short, we sort of did the festival. We're like, oh yeah, that was interesting. And we figured out we'd actually agreed to do the festival for no pay. It was a no paying festival. This was not, none of us knew this until the gig was completed and we're on our way home. But yeah, so there's a lesson. Always check the contract before you agree to a gig.
Well, I'd say a lot of the contracts are very loose in this world.
Yeah, they can be loose. Well, some of them are verbal. Some of them, I think this one was pretty verbal. But yeah, they can go either way. But that was a bit interesting, I thought. But so, you know, if they can get away putting on a festival where they don't pay the artists, I don't know how the hell they did that, but they did.
Yeah, well, I've got one which I'm happy to explain. The one and only time I did a gig, which you were at my old university. And somehow I like got caught up in arranging a gig at the local bar to sort of drive more people there or something. It was
at the local uni bar, yeah.
At the uni bar, yeah. And I got a couple of bands. And then I just started doing posters and all that sort of stuff. And so first failure I had was I did all the posters and some of the posters misspelt one of the band's names.
That's a classic. Yep.
They left, so one of the bands that we had playing there was the Delta Reeks, and they left a G off one of the Reeks. You know how it was R-I-G-G-S, I think?
To this day, it's still that, yeah.
Yeah, to this day, it's still that. So yeah, they left the G off and I was like, oh, fuck, here we go.
I like how they left the G off, not you.
Yeah, they did.
It's a good one, yeah.
Yeah, and then I proceeded to keep doing it and I was like having to sell tickets for this thing beforehand and I think I might have sold, like, and the bar was dead. Like, this is at a university on the Gold Coast, which is notorious for not having any fucking substance.
Yeah.
Shout out to Bond University.
Yeah.
And I probably sold, I want to say 50 to 100 tickets, maybe. But on the day of, I remember, I think I was speaking to you, like, all of the band stuff was turning up and I didn't realize that you needed a PA. I just thought bands turned up and plugged in their shit to their amps. And like, I've got guitars and shit. Like I've played music.
You've been to a few live shows in your life.
I've been to a few. I thought that they just plug into their amp and shit and off they go. And you're like, I remember you saying even it was the day of or some, I'm sure it was you.
Yeah.
You're like, you need an amp, man. Like, you definitely need an amp.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, fuck. And
the day of the gig, yep.
So the day of, and then the day of, good friend of the show, Bitrock pulled out. I had Bitrock as well.
Right.
Doing, yeah. He could smell the fire festival vibes.
Yeah.
Obviously, yeah. And thought, this is gonna be a shit show. I'm not turning up. So
for those that are doing the research quickly, Bitrock is now Otter San, who's doing bloody mad shit on Triple J, so check it out. Continue.
Yeah, legend, like great DJ, great. It was below them, but they were doing it. But so he actually gave us his decks and me and you, I think, DJ, maybe, or
we did. Kind. We did it. We spun some tunes, but we did we get the? Because sorry, you continue. Yeah.
So anyway, yeah. So like, the PA cost $900 or something to rent for like the day. It was huge. Yeah. I got a PA big enough for like Warp Tour, and and I sold like X amount of tickets, and I ended up losing. I remember like a couple of grand because I wanted to pay the guys because everything went to charity, obviously.
Yeah.
So I think I gave the rigs maybe a couple of $100.
Yep.
And they probably would have been like, "What the fuck is this?" And we were doing it, and we gave, and we ended. I had to end up, even though I'd lost money, I had to give something to charity because it was like a charity event. So I had to dip into my own pocket to pay the charity, and it just. But the only thing is like the rigs played amazingly,
and I remember. Because me and friend of the show, Dave, had to man, we were doing the sound for the show.
That's
on this,
right.
On this PA you'd hired.
Mm.
And we were not that well versed in live sound at the time.
But it sounded, the rigs always sound good. I mean, so.
Yeah. And we did an amazing job. I mean, yeah.
So that's how I sort of could relate to Billy McFarlane's idea.
Yep.
And I'm not saying that the difference is I wasn't trying to get laid. I was just trying to do something for university to improve the culture and raise some money for charity.
And charity, yeah, exactly. I can very much see how you might have been having flashbacks watching that doco.
Yeah, I was a little bit. And I remember my car ended up almost getting towed because I had to unload all the gear. And the unfortunate part of that is I've had so many things in business that have ended up like that. And yeah, it's a horrible feeling. Yeah, but it's good when it all...
We learned. Well, you learn from there that bands need a PA. If nothing else, you learn that.
Bands need a PA. And, yeah. I mean, the thing that Billy McFarlane had is he had heaps of money behind him and he also had a festival that was sold out. He just needed to do his budgets better.
I know. That's what I mean. Like, it had potential to actually succeed if he wasn't such a bell-end.
Yeah, like you try to get people to – him getting people to the Bahamas, I'm telling you, trying to get people to Bond University's bar is a lot harder than trying to get people to a beautiful island in the Bahamas with supermodels.
Yeah, yeah, well, there's some differences there.
Yeah, so I don't know. I'm surprised you don't have more.
Well, you got to think, going to a festival, I barely remember most of the festivals, but disasters, nah.
Has there been any ones where you've had gigs and you've turned up and there's been no one there?
Yes.
Pretty much just like, you know, 10 people or whatever.
Do you remember Good Vibes?
Yeah, of course.
The festival on the Goldie?
Yeah, that was good, wasn't it?
That was a good one, yeah. But we played the opening slot, which I believe was 12 midday. So,
how many years ago would that have been?
That would have been in about 2010 or something, 2009. But I remember starting off and going, you know, we'd done a couple of those at that time, so we weren't too fussed on it. It means we can have a play and then just get stuck into partying ourselves. But, we played Good Vibes and we started out playing to literally not one single person. But they must have just opened the gates around that time. So it was amazing, like about... 10 or 15 minutes into this set, it was like a herd of buffalo or something coming over this grassy hill at the end of the tent. And all of a sudden, these people started storming into the tent. So we ended up with a decent couple of hundred or whatever for that last part of the set. But it was a really cool feeling that they actually wanted to come see us because they heard us as soon as they came in.
Oh, the cool calm... I'm not going to toot your horn, but they definitely have that If you hear it at a festival, you go to it.
Yeah.
I reckon I remember at the Big Day Out one year where there was maybe like a couple of hundred people watching you guys, or I don't know how many, like, but it ended up being the full tent, partway through, like the full tent, like,
it was heaving. So, I remember that gig.
Heaving. What year was that?
I don't know. It was the same year Neil Young played, though. I remember that.
Yeah. And were the Streets playing on after you, or was that another year?
That was another year. Lupe was there that year.
Lupe, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
That was Neil Young playing. But, actually, for anyone who is interested in coming and seeing my band, just while we're talking about it, are playing one of the last gigs at the Cherry Bar before it moves down in Melbourne on the 15th of February. So if you're in the area, come on down, say g'day.
Yeah, get out there and do it. Definitely one of the better bands I've seen live, you guys. You're a really good live band.
Yeah, we're the best on earth. So yeah,
best on earth. Best in the galaxy,
fuck,
some might say. So,
best in every dimension.
Yeah, yes.
But yes. Shall we talk about the elephant in the room?
Yeah, we can. So all those... So how are we going to start with this?
Well, do you reckon? That's a very good question. Do we start with a couple of... okay, so this week there was the findings of a report into the Banking Royal Commission was released by Kenneth Hain.
Yep.
Do you want to run through maybe some of the bigger talking points that came away from that first, and then we can get stuck into how that may or may not affect things? Or...
Yeah, I mean, I might just start with probably the biggest talking point, which I think everyone's either confused or unaware of, and a lot of things in finance and insurance and all that sort of stuff, consumers get these products and they think a lot of the time that they don't understand the earn that these people are making. So one of the largest uproars that we heard was from the Mortgage Brokers of Australia, basically, and their concern over the Hain report has recommended to remove their trails from their earns, which is essentially a fee that they get for the life of a loan. So say you take out a home loan for a house for $750,000, they get a couple of $100 a month on top of, say, their $10,000 fee that they get for placing that loan for the life of your loan. So these trails are basically money people would say.
Is that their bread and butter? Or is that
it's their
really
bread and
nice
butter. People buy books of trails. So people buy and sell them. So, like, they're considered a really, they're the gravy of that industry, exactly. So
they're getting charged for doing, like, just to be clear, for doing literally nothing.
For doing literally nothing. But what they will say, and I've a lot of friends who are in this industry, what they will say is that it's part of their fee. But if you take in, so say for a $750,000 loan, I don't have a calculator on me, but those at home, okay. So a $750,000 loan, their upfront earn could be $5,000 to $10,000.
Yeah.
Then their trail earn could be roughly, let's say,
over the life of the loan.
Yeah, and this is just a $750 loan. $750,000 loan. Let's say their trial for that is $100 to $200. We're going to get people's. We're not doing exact numbers here.
Yep.
So then that goes for 30 years. Say the loan's for 30 years.
Yeah.
So they could be earning $35,000 on the placement of a $750,000 loan, which is fucking.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money.
It certainly is. So why is this? I mean, initially, why is this allowed? Do you say they build that into their fees, or?
Yeah, they build it. Well, they what they're saying now, they're saying if you remove it from our, if you remove our trials, we'll front load the.
So the either loans. Way, it'll be passed on to.
Yeah, which is not true because people are using Finder.com or iSelect for loans, and they're not using brokers as much. It's same with insurance and all that.
So when you say that they pass on those costs anyway, that wouldn't be the case because you'd be able to find a lender that was doing a better offer on something like iSelect or something. Is that what you mean? Or
it's my personal opinion that they are in a industry like broking in general that could potentially be dying off anyway.
Yeah.
And it's one of the, yeah, I think it's one of the next sort of casualties of, one of the next casualties of the online world, essentially.
Yeah. And the way things are just moving. Yeah.
Exactly. So do I feel like they should get it? I don't know.
Do you feel like they should what, sorry?
Do I feel like they should get the trials? I mean, I don't know. Every financial and insurance product gets trials. So
who's paying that trial?
Well, the consumer essentially pays it, but it's all wrapped up in as part of their fee.
Yeah, yeah.
So, for instance, life insurance just recently copped this similar sort of thing, right? So back in the day, maybe a couple up until 2 years ago or something, life insurance / superannuation advisors and stuff like that would sometimes get paid 120% of the price of the policy up front as a fee, right? From the underwriter of the life insurance product. So what that promoted them to do is sell really hard without probably, you know, disclosing all of the information involved in the product necessarily.
And get it over the line, whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. And that since has recently got scrapped. And so the life insurance and superannuation industry, they've gone under strict review and strict changes to the point where they've made all of their reps and all, if you want to be in that space, you have to have a university degree and you have to, your product disclosure is different. You can only have a certain amount of clients. So, mate, I don't know. How do you feel about it after, like, from you seeing it and what's something that stood out to you as a bad thing?
Oh, there's parts of the nuance of some of it I don't particularly understand. That's why I'll have to talk with some of it through with you, I'd say. But there was a few things that came out of it from my understanding of what's sort of happening here. There's probably three main things like that I took away from it. One thing is what is ASIC doing, the Australian Consumer, no, the, what is it, the Australian Securities?
Australian Securities and Investment Commission or whatever.
Yeah, so this is an actual body that exists to regulate this stuff anyway, right?
Totally, yeah.
And so they, by all accounts, have done nothing and have had a terrible track record of convicting or getting anyone in trouble for these discretions over many decades now. So I feel like, I mean, they're talking about the ACCC getting involved there or something, but which is probably a good thing. I mean, anything would be good rather than letting the banks regulate themselves, which by all accounts seems to be happening.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So
yeah, man, I think ASIC has probably got, I don't know how big ASIC's team. Like, as far as I know, that sounds, but like the role of ASIC in Australian business and Australian society, I don't even know if they've got the legs to manage what is going on. I mean, there was an
article. But they should have the legs, you know?
Yeah, they should definitely
have the legs. Why do they exist unless they have the legs to do something?
Exactly, but this Phoenix company issue, which we've been talking about on the Reed Pod quite a bit prior to obviously doing the Brass Monkey Pod, and if you are a listener of the Reed Pod and you're listening to this on the Reed Pod, subscribe to the Brass Monkey Podcast on iTunes. Just hop on over, search the Brass Monkey Podcast. This Phoenix company stuff, I think it was $500 million last year, was lost in this Phoenix company stuff, which in Queensland alone, which is heavy, and ASIC are meant to try to pursue that. I think bigger
people. There's a long list of people that the ABC, I mean, I was looking at them before. There's a huge long list of big things that they should have been able to get some results on and just have not been able to.
Nah, because of the money and the judicial process, and I'm sure they get to the point where they have to view every single case as a financial cost sort of benefit. So they've got to sit there and probably look at it like any business, even though they're a government regulated, they'd have to look at it. All right, so if we spend, $10 million fighting this and we're going against NAB, is it worth it? Are we going to end up getting anywhere? What's going to be the end game? I think
the end game is to help the consumer and to protect the consumer.
Which I think that's a really hard job. I think if you take anything out of this, for me, broking is dying, and someone who has been in that space for a long time.
Yeah, definitely. But there's a couple other things. That ASIC thing, that's because. Because I've heard ScoMo bloody going on about how he's given more money to ASIC and he should actually be thanked for giving them more power and shit. Well, if they've been given more power, why is this happening? Also, it's unfathomable to me that there's sitting members in Parliament right now that have voted against this for so long.
Yeah. And you think... Well, that's because of a lot of them are beneficiaries from this industry. So this industry is so fast spreading, I think is what I'm trying to say. It's so wide, I think, that people are being scared of what might come out of a report like this.
Yeah, but that's certainly... I mean, they're scared because there's some bad shit that has gone on. That's why. That's certainly no reason not to have it. It means that they're doing dodgy shit and they're going to get exposed for it.
And I think that's just sort of answering why I think like a lot of the opposition and things like that have been voting against it, because it's the same with when there's building and construction, the Building Construction Commission and things like that. Like, mate, look at what's happening with that tower in Sydney. There's so much shit that people in that industry know about what went wrong with that building.
Yeah.
Basically
what we're talking about is greasy palm. People making backdoor deals, getting kicked back in some way, shape or form.
There's no question, mate. Yeah.
So that's literally what it comes down to. We have to hold their feet to the fire. Otherwise, what is the point of politics or democracy?
Yeah, I agree. And I think...
Here's a quote just quickly from Barnaby Joyce. In the past, I argued against the Royal Commission into banking. I was wrong. What I've heard so far is beyond disturbing. Mate, you get paid a lot of money to be in the position you're in to know these things on our behalf. So if you're not... capable or don't possess the capacity to do that, get out of the job, forfeit the amazing pay packet. You just don't get to call ignorance in this situation. And there's plenty of them doing it. Kelly O'Dwyer, the financial services minister, fucking boiled my blood. She was on Q&A the other night. I don't know if you saw that.
No, I didn't. What did she have to say?
Just not admitting to anything,
they're never going to.
Well, a few of them are. Like Barnaby's just said it. ScoMo's come out and tried to claim that he's actually made a real push for this now, and it's him that's really got it going. Do you know what I mean? When he in 2016, dismissed calls for a royal commission as a populist whinge. Now that's the former treasurer, now PM. I just, mate, this, it boils my blood. These guys have to go.
They have to go.
It's so obvious.
But I think, I do strongly believe we're moving very quickly in time at the moment, as far as I think we're making changes in lots of different industries at a really fast rate. And the financial services and insurance and all of that sort of industry, mate, it is the next Uber. Like I'm saying, it's all good. Like these politicians should get in, like they should have pushed it a long time ago and all this sort of stuff. But mate, it is a dying industry as far as, it's pretty much dead. As far as the biggest issues people are having in is the non-disclosure of fees. People, the consumer, not understanding what they're being charged and why they're getting charged.
And there not being a legal framework that the people should have to work within.
Exactly, mate. So I think
that's a failment of on government.
It is, totally. Well, it's an industry that got, me and you were sort of hitting up back and forth, but like the mortgage broking industry and the broking industry in general, it's been pushed on us from government. It's been pushed on us. My dad was, like people were telling me how it used to be. And like when the mortgage broking like industry first started, like there were no doc line, there were loans with no docs. So basically you get loans based on fucking the smallest amount of information and the mortgage broker would just be able to put it together. So you end up getting, getting approved or whatever.
So it's basically what's happening to that.
It's essentially, it's a lot harder to lend now, but I mean,
that's what they're saying. That's what this has come about because of exactly those same practices.
Yeah, exactly. So, it'll be interesting to see. I was shocked when I heard like all the mortgage brokers in an uproar about the trail stuff. I mean, surely they would have known that this was coming. I had a lot of friends in that space, and I think, I don't know, I feel like this is happening to everyone in the financial services industry. So I think they're all in a position that could be, their fee structures are going to be changing quite dramatically.
And probably rightfully so.
Yeah, probably rightfully so, I think. Yeah.
I can't get on board with, it's just such a big problem. We shouldn't really tackle it full on and at full pace. You know what I mean? That's often how these things go so long without being fixed.
Tell you, they've fixed the life insurance and superannuation industry. I wouldn't say it's 100% fixed, but if you're looking, if you look into the sweeping changes that they did there, so you used to be able to door knock to sell life insurance and stuff like that. Right. And there were these companies making like fucking hundreds of millions of dollars. And you see there's lots about no hawking in that report. So like that was a big one where people were just so sales focused. And these products like home loans, like insurance, life insurance, they shouldn't be sales focused. Yeah. They should be need focused.
Yep.
And
to restructure the commissions and like what is the motivating factor to, you
exactly
know?
Rather than earning more money for making the sale, rather than earning more money for making the client stay for longer
or the quality of the package you've given to them or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly, man. So I think it's good. I think it's good that it's been done, and it'll be interesting whether the changes get implemented. I don't know. Like, because they're just recommendations.
Yeah.
I don't know if they have to be actually, like, I don't know if the government's put anything in place to actually say they will implement X, Y, and Z. The trail income, I mean, you got to realize, like, I know I keep repeating this, but there's 30,000 loans that mortgage brokers write a month.
Yeah, okay? I heard that somewhere, yeah.
So the trail, this trail business is, the money in it is so much money. You know.
Well, it seems to me like from a very unsophisticated look at it that you could just take that whole part out of it, not charge the consumer or and the guy doesn't get it or the girl doesn't
If you
get
took
it.
That part out and didn't charge the consumer, people would be having an extra bloody shitload of money in their, you know, pockets for groceries each month.
Yeah.
But their argument would be saying we do the work for it, which...
But they get that initial sum that you said.
Yeah, so they would say that that's not enough.
Well, they're wrong.
Yeah, I know, but it's hard to define what is enough. Yeah.
That's where there needs to be some oversight by someone that is not within the industry.
Yeah, exactly. So
for someone other than ASIC or someone.
Well, there's industry standards in industries like insurance broking where you can't... If it's found that you charge greater than X percentage, it's considered not fair and reasonable. So
yeah,
for
it's not
instance,
to community standards or health.
Yeah, so like standards. if you say there's a policy or something that costs $1,000, right? And that's the total cost of the policy. If you're a broker and you earn say 40% of that cost, well, it's way above what industry standards should be because you shouldn't be earning that much because you're actually only facilitating the placement of that business.
And whereas, it also, for sure, and then it also incentivizes you to just be pumping those things out as well.
Well, they could say it incentivizes you to push cheaper options where you can front load larger fees for yourself. So that's...
Yeah.
Yeah, see this, so that's where it's a whole complex game. I think everything's good. I think, you know, the fact that they've done this report, I think it's a positive, and I think the consumer will end up winning out of it. But I think in the end, the consumer's going to win in the end with the internet, with the things like Amazon getting into the insurance game. I know that sounds horrible, but it just is what it is. It's going to make it more cost-effective.
Yeah.
If you're talking about cost, it's going to lose shitloads of jobs. But if you want something cheaper, which everyone does these days, everything's gone online. So all of these old-school brokers that are getting these, you know, half a million in trails each year.
No more.
It's not the way the game is anymore.
I need to know, what is your position on these politicians that have voted against it? Do you think there should be any repercussions? Like,
that's your biggest thing, and I'm interested in that. I know what you mean. Someone was saying this about. Oh, someone said to me this. Can I circle back to what you've asked? Someone was saying that about like with the YouTube changing their censorship. Laws to get rid of conspiracy videos, and they're deeming what's a conspiracy. And someone said, well, if you can't even say the P-gate term without your stuff getting censored at the moment.
Right.
But if it's found out that's true, should YouTube be responsible and held liable, like in some sort of way for blocking the freedom of information?
Yes.
About that topic, because they're
if they're going to be a moral arbiter in that way, then yes.
Because I mean, even with this podcast, if we mention the P-gate topic, they're apparently screening podcasts, they're screening definitely screening YouTube videos that discuss it. Imagine it's found out that that's real. Who should be liable? So that's a totally different thing.
Liable for what? But I know.
Well, not liable, but shouldn't their heads roll for screening information that's fucking real?
Yes, and that's what I was speaking about in a previous thing. Like, if they're going to go down this road, like you were saying that they should be able to ban Alex Jones because they're a private company, la 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 la. Whereas I was erring on the side of we should be more, and they should be more thinking themselves as like a public utility. And in that sense, you can't, it's not your place to morally, you know, dictate these things.
I'm with you. And I didn't see the position of what happens if you are screening real content So content that is considered to be fake or not real or whatever, whoever considers whatever. So if you do start doing that, I didn't really think of it from the other side, that if you are screening this stuff that is potentially true, which a lot of people believe in, and you're saying it's not true and it comes out that it is, surely you have some sort of responsibility. And surely there should be some recourse over that. I don't know.
There would. And there would be, but I'd imagine in that situation the recourse would come via the audience participation in that service. Like, it would take a massive hit, and the consumers and customers themselves would speak with their actions as to whether they still use that service or whether they go elsewhere for stuff from that point on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So they take that risk, I guess. But these polos, mate, I didn't answer.
Yeah, so no, I don't think they'll get shit. I think they should if they voted against it. But there's stuff that they vote against all the time. Because
I guess the recourse for that is then their constituents should not vote them back in again, I guess.
100%. So, yeah. If you're sitting here right now and you're, say your home loan's in a bad way, or say you've been you've got a policy that you're not happy with, let's say it's a life insurance policy that's not right or whatever else, well, you shouldn't be voting if your constituent or your local politician or whoever voted against this report, well, you should be considering that, because that hits your back pocket and it impacts your life.
Yeah. I just feel like the media should be getting on this a bit more or something. I just don't like it.
Yeah, well, we both
know. For Turnbull to come out and go, it was a really bad political move not to have got this going earlier.
Mm.
That in itself shows just a separation from the population. It's not a political thing, Malcolm. It actually affects consumers.
But Malcolm was part of one of the largest corporate insurance collapses in Australian history with HIH.
100%, but it speaks to why these people shouldn't be running the country.
Yeah, exactly, mate. Exactly. So, which gets further to our point, which is look at different alternatives and look at different ways to doing things. I mean, for me, lending, we grew up in this, like you and me and, you know, anyone slightly older than us have grown up in this society where lending is what you do. You borrow money and it's a good way to make money. We've sort of been fed this whole narrative it's important to borrow money and get property and do all this, but it's a fucking trap, in my opinion.
You've brought this up. Yeah.
I think the whole industry and the whole idea of borrowing money at an interest rate is a really, really bad trap to get into. Negative gearing, which a lot of people got sucked into for many years, is a horrible, horrible practice. It really just all negative gearing does is, and this is not advice.
Fucks the rest of us.
It fucks the rest of us, but it also fucks the person doing it in the way that it traps you into getting a job where you're earning enough money to cover the tax that you need to be paying for the negative gearing.
Yeah.
So it doesn't prep you for what happens if you leave your job, what happens if you get fired. What happens so negative gearing in that I've always positively geared shit and paid tax, because if I'm positively gearing, I'm not buying property to for now. I'm buying property to help me get out of my job. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I'm not buying property to help me fucking keep working in an office for 20 years.
Oh,
so.
I hear you, man. But that's actually, the concept of that being in debt and in credit is just a given in life is wrong, and something I think we need to think about. And the fact that I think it's potentially different if you're investing in business and property and stuff like that, but even on just a general credit card basis and small loan sort of a thing, it again speaks to the fact that just the wealth inequality and the you know, the average, what is it, the potential earn, like the earning, what we earn now has the same buying power as it did in 1973, sort of a thing.
Mm,
like, yeah. We're just not earning enough as a population, and the cost of living is skyrocketing, and then
so
all these credit things start opening up, and I just don't think we should be living in a society where it's such a necessity for so many people to have to be in debt.
Mate, I never used to agree with it, but I do agree with it now. So what I suggest for me, for Brass Monkey listeners and anyone who ever wants to listen to whatever the fuck we're talking about, what I would suggest if I was 20 years old right now, I would save up what I can over however long I can. Say it's a year and I get 25 grand. And I would jump on realestate.com and I'd put my limit at 25 grand and I'd search Australia-wide. I wouldn't search in fucking Bondi. I wouldn't search, obviously, in Brunswick or fucking... Yeah. I would get something that I can own outright, whether it's a bit of land, and then I'd hold on to it for a little bit, own it outright, and then I'd move on to something else. Forget using these banks to grow your wealth. Yeah. I don't think that is a happy way to live, let alone
but it's financially. A story we've been sold, isn't it?
Exactly, mate.
Yeah.
Because everyone's made money hand over fist in a property in Australia, but the stresses that come with lending money and the stresses that come with trying to pay those bills each month, I mean, it's not a happy lifestyle. It's just keeping us all on the wheel, but there is properties still in Australia. If you jump online, there's Tasmania you can still invest in. There's places where, you know, people can put money aside and buy places outright that they could sit on for 5-10 years and you never know, it might go nuts, and then you can afford something in your local neighborhood where you want to live. But
no, I agree, man. That's it's a very good point.
Like, if I could have my way, that's what I would be doing.
Yeah, that's good advice. I like it.
Yeah. So, mate, good pod. Great
good pod. Great. Hopefully there's some info for people to look further into in there. And
yeah. Heavy pod. Very heavy
pod. Heavy pod, yeah. It's good.
Jesus. Oh, we've almost forgot we're calling bullshit.
Oh, yes. Go on. I'll let you tee this up.
Calling bullshit. Haven't called bullshit for ages. First calling bullshit ever on the Brass Monkey podcast. Wait. Once again, subscribe, jump on board to hear all of our calling bullshits. But I shot you a text about calling bullshit on...
About tea time, was it? About dinner time?
Around dinner time. And I mean, this is a real... you got to tiptoe around this topic, but when
I'm surprised you're bringing it up, to be honest. Yeah.
All right. How do you say this? So, say I'm making dinner, right?
Yeah.
And I've made dinner, and it's like, well, for instance, packeted ravioli or something, and everyone says thank you for the packeted ravioli that I've put out.
Yeah.
But I then get offended for not complimenting the taste of the packeted ravioli. And I was saying to you that I don't think you can claim the flavor and should expect not a thank you. Cause
extra kudos. Yeah.
Extra kudos. Like I'm thankful for the meal and I'm thankful for it being prepared and I'm thankful for everything. But I don't think you can expect extra kudos for opening the packet and boiling it.
Oh, that's just horrible, man. I mean, honestly, sometimes you don't realize how much goes into the actual stirring technique into the pasta.
But when you get it, but you know what I mean? It's sort of like...
Oh, mate, I do.
Yeah, I don't know how deep to go on this because, fuck, the podcast has caused more issues than I've ever wanted it to in my life. But
I think the listeners understand what you're getting at. I I understand what you're getting at. I agree with what you're saying.
Great.
And that's actually just full stop, because I have it a bit here too.
And it could be when you cook it, like maybe you feel like you should get a thank you when you open that packet up.
Exactly. No, you're right. It works both ways. But the ravioli, that's a last minute save move. You're not looking for taste when you're opening a packet of Latino fresh or whatever and dumping some sauce on it, are you? And if I didn't want to thank them, then I'd write to Latina Pasta.
So
thank them for their sauce.
So where do you draw the
line? Sorry to anyone that might have recently cooked Latina Pasta.
Yeah, fully. So where would you draw the line? Like, is there like a type of meal that crosses that threshold? Because I guess...
gets into the territory of, okay, this deserves a taste, thank you.
Exactly, like...
There might be, for instance,
what if, and this is hypotheticals, right?
Yeah.
What if like steak and salad's made, and like steak and salad, you're pretty much like, it's going to be pretty much the same. Like if it's a good steak, it's going to taste the same. That's a great steak. Good job. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I feel like that's in the realm of requiring a thank you.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's a difference between thank you and complimenting the chef.
That's in the realm of compliments for me.
Okay,
because
good.
You can fuck up a steak, but you can't really fuck up Latina Pasta.
No, you can't, even though I have.
Yeah, I'm sure you could, but just generally.
Yeah.
So, like, another instance might be if... You know, it always comes down to, shit, what have we got in the fridge? Nothing. Okay, what can we do here? So if I were to just throw some cheese on a bit of bread and toast it, probably wouldn't expect a compliment.
I made cheese toasties yesterday for the kids.
Well, this is what I'm getting to. If you just whack cheese on the bread and, you know, you whack it in the toaster, that is not requiring of a compliment. However... On that cheese on toast, were you to add perhaps some Italian herbs, maybe chuck a couple of olives that were left over in the fridge.
Yes, yes.
Perhaps then you're getting in the territory of requiring a compliment, you know what I mean? But it does take that commitment to wanting the dish to be better enhanced by your own skills, if that makes sense.
No, I get you. I get you. And we're not talking wives, husbands, boyfriends. We're just saying, like, in general, like, we might feel like this where we've made stuff and we're not getting the love we feel like we deserved. So it's a broad stroke of the brush, this.
It is, mate.
But I do think it's a tough one. I feel like you've got to just go all out and compliment. You know what a really funny one is? I was just thinking then is... tacos, where you get that mix, where you get the taco mix in the packet.
So if
you get that taco mix in the packet, I'm complimenting it. I'm saying like that's not like just a heating, but the flavor is really coming just from that taco mix in the packet.
That is in good gray area territory, I think.
Like you're not getting out the mortar and pestle and dipping your finger in and going
down the trees out the backyard. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm with that. See, with my tacos, I go the extra distance with my taco mix. So I'm like putting a bit of beef stock in there as well and some water and then adding that stuff later. So
yeah, okay.
I think it might have to be a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. So we're calling bullshit on complimenting the chef. That's our first calling bullshit, which really is not what I saw coming for our first calling bullshit.
No, but it's a decent one, and I'm sure one many people could probably relate to. And it always happens both ways. It's a funny thing. It's good.
Yeah. So that's us. That's us wrapped up.
Bloody good one, mate. Bloody good one. Awesome. We'll be back this time next week or around this time, give or take a week. No,
going to try to do one to two. Yeah, going to try to do 1 to 2 pods a week, aren't we? On Brass Monkey, sort of just to, if time permits. We're going to load these up on the Reed Pod as well, but as we sort of briefly touched on, we're killing off the Reed Pod, moving moving it over to a more regular pod with Sozwa on the Brass Monkey.
Yeah. If you guys have any questions or want to shoot us an email, you can reach us at either Soren, S-O-R-E-N, at Brass Monkey, BRSSMNKY.com, or the same,
yo,
which is Mark at the start, M-A-R-K at BRSSMNKY.com.
That's right. Send us your hate and your love, and also
send us your favorite memes.
Favorite memes, calling, and you're calling bullshits.
Yeah, please. If you've got any suggestions, we'd love to hear them.
Because we started, I mean, we've gone straight deep with the call and bullshit on Praising the Chef, which is the softest one we've had. We've had Kanye West in the past. We've had fucking
Interested to see how this calling bullshit plays out for you, buddy.
Yeah, I'm interested to see. Can't go any worse than the rest of the podcasts I've done.
Well,
Jesus. But hope this is take about 24 of the Brass Monkey podcast. You guys don't see what goes on behind the scenes, but this one is actually going up. So we're really pumped, aren't we?
Yes, we've been crafting our skills for you. As you can probably hear over the last hour, amazing stuff, obviously.
Exactly. All right. Well, thanks for listening.
All right. Catch you soon, my friend.
All right, buddy. Have a great week.
Catch you.
Catch you. Bye.